Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, a podcast channel for the New Books Network. I'm CJ, one of your hosts for the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Christopher Kelty about his new book, The Participant, A Century of Participation in Four Stories. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Chris, I wonder if you could begin the interview by just telling us a bit about yourself, a bit about your background and your training.
Sure. I'm currently a professor at UCLA. I have a pretty strange interdisciplinary setup here. I'm in a place called the Institute for Society and Genetics, which is an interdisciplinary unit department, really, that crosses social sciences and life sciences. But I'm trained as an anthropologist and a science studies scholar. I got my PhD from MIT's STS program. And I have been doing work on all kinds of different things. So I wrote a book a while ago about the development and history of free software, thinking about the unusual social and technical relations between software and public spheres. And some of that led me on the path to doing some of the work that was formed the basis for this book, The Participant. And so that's where we're at.
Great. So how exactly did you come about this project? Because I know it took you a while to complete it. Because, I mean, you know, as the title suggests, it's a century of participation. So how did you come to cover this amount of participation while at the same time narrowing it down to, well, you know, ostensibly four specific stories or studies?
Yeah. Well, it was an interesting development. It was, so after I was sort of done with the work on free software, it was kind of, and so this, that came back, book came out in 2008. So there was a lot of enthusiasm for new uses for the internet that were being labeled participatory, right? So there were a lot of like crowdsourcing, crowdfunding kinds of things, precursors to the gig economy, things like couch surfing or time banking or whatnot. So there was a lot of things going on, and some graduate students and I were really tracking these and doing case studies of all these different forms of participation on the internet. And we were doing some comparisons. We've published several papers about thinking about what kind of participation is at stake in these different internet-enabled technologies, some via social media, some more app-based like citizen science projects and whatnot. And it was in the midst of that, I would say somewhere around maybe 2011 or 2012. I think it was 2011 because it was before Edward Snowden. I had a colleague of mine ask me, he said, well, what, you know, you're doing all this work on participation. What is the genealogy of that concept? And I said, I'm not entirely sure I know, but maybe I should write a paper about that. And it was a rabbit hole, it turns out. So I immediately started finding just case after case after case of people trying to do participatory this or that. And what it came with were not just attempts to create participation in different domains, but also attempts to study it in different domains. So it really turned into a pretty natural kind of science studies project in that sense, because I was asking not just what is participation and how does it work, but who studied it and how. What kinds of tools and techniques were being used to try and understand this thing called participation and by whom and where. And so for a long time, I was doing a project that I was calling the heteronyms of participation, because I kept finding, you know, I would finish researching like participation at work and discover that there was a whole field of participation in art. And then I would finish doing that and I would find a whole field of participation in international development and on and on. And so I was collecting them all and I was trying to figure out how to sort them out. And the process of turning the book into four stories was a much longer one after I realized that I kind of needed to figure out which ones were most important, because if you just do all of them, then you have this giant atlas of participation. Nobody really wants to read that. So I had to kind of narrow it down and figure out where to focus my attention in those stories.
Yeah, so yet your book still has this really interesting, unique formatting and organization of it. So you have these, you know, the main four stories, but you also have these various vignettes of this character who you called the participant. So who is the participant? What can you tell me about these vignettes?
Yeah. So that came about halfway through doing the book. And I realized as part of the argument in the book, one of the things I was starting to focus on was how in most cases of participation, especially the studies of participation or the attempts to make them happen, the thing that sort of falls out of the story is what it feels like, what the experience of participation really feels like. And that's something that I think most people who've done anything collective can intuit, right? Whether it's, you know, a sense of participation in a seminar or being in a crowd or a mob or being part of a team or any, you know, anything like that, that people know what it feels like. And yet that falls out of the stories. And so one of the things I set myself the task of doing in the book was to try and reconstruct those experiences, right? Really the sort of affective and more detailed experience of what it felt like to be, as I put it in the book, an instance of a collective, not just an individual with a memory and a subjectivity, but someone who all of a sudden feels themselves to be part of something bigger. And what is that feeling like? And so, you know, I could have done a study of any kind of participation. I could have gone and, you know, camped out with Occupy. I could have done the Citizen Science Project. I could have studied, and I, you know, had studied free software projects, which are very participatory. And so there were a lot of opportunities to do any particular kind of participation. But what really emerged as a question for me was whether you could do participation in participation, right? Could you just actually analyze this thing as such? And that, I have to admit, was a little bit of a weird quest to go on. There's a certain quixotic nature to that, because you can't be in all these different places at once. But what I needed to do that was a character who I could follow around. So the participant was sort of an invention, a kind of methodological invention to see if I could get at different experiences of participation by doing a kind of mix of archival work and reconstruction and a little bit of imaginative work on my own to try and pinpoint some of those experiences and really kind of describe them. So that's where the participant came from.
Yeah, it's a really innovative approach to it. I really appreciated that in your book. I was wondering if you could explain to your audience what contributory autonomy is, because this plays, as a concept, this also plays such a crucial role throughout your book. And I was wondering, how does it help us think about participation today, and how does it relate to participation as experience, if you will?
Sure. So there's really sort of a tripartite approach in the book. I try to think about participation as a concept, as a procedure, and as an experience in all the stories that I tell. And thinking about it as a concept and the way that gets then turned into a procedure led me to think about it in terms of this concept of contributory autonomy. And what's really at stake there is just this sense that for a lot of people who are trying to produce participation, the place they start is with a sense of individuals aggregated into a whole, right? So that if you want crowdsourcing to happen, then you set up a procedure whereby individuals can each on their own, in their own way, contribute something, which then produces a sense of a whole, whether that be a whole collective or just a product of some sort, like in the case of a free software, Wikipedia, those kinds of things. And so what I was trying to pinpoint there was just the way in which we often make an opposition between collective and individual, where we miss what's happening when people contribute something in order to produce a collective, right? And so if you're an individual and you produce, you know, a vote, then you're contributing to a collective that is the entire election, right? And that kind of contributory autonomy is, in fact, a kind of personhood. We do tend to think of ourselves as individuals in that way, like my role in society is to contribute. And I think that's actually a kind of historical formation. It's something that has gotten more and more intense over the course of the 20th century. And it's in part because of the proceduralization of participation and the downplaying of the feeling of experience as being an instance of a collective. And so there are a lot of cases in the book where I try to look at how contributory autonomy has kind of taken over what it means to participate. And I'll just give you one example, and I can talk about the chapters in more detail later if you want. But I look at one case in the 1960s of the Model Cities program in Philadelphia, which is a kind of classic case of participation in administration in U.S. politics. And the thing that makes that so interesting is that before Model Cities, what it meant to participate, what really meant to be part of a neighborhood or a neighborhood organization or a social movement or an ethnic group. And it was those groups that participated in something. Those groups were the ones that were being called to participate in administration. And after that, really what we did was put into place a system of participation in federal administration that's very individualized, where it's individuals who participate. And that transition, I think, is a long one, but one that you can really see in the 20th century taking place with the increasing proceduralization of participation. And I'm not really the first person to notice this. It's just that it fits as the best framework for explaining participation. A lot of the work that's been done in science studies over the last, 20 years or so has really sort of opened up this field of thinking about participation as a kind of experiment or participation as something that has a procedural or formatted aspect to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I was actually wondering if we could get into the first story here, talking about, many aspects of the story, but particularly the work of Levi Brühl and how you talk about his development of understanding of participation, thinking about an anthropology of ethics. So why start here with this story, and how does this help us think about participation, going forward with this?
Yeah, it's a bit of a rough going chapter, I think, in some ways. It depends on the reader. In some ways, it's there because people told me to cut it. When people do that, then I respond by trying to bring it more to the fore. But I think, for people who are interested in the book, one thing to understand about it is that it has basically four stories. Three of them are really 20th century stories, and those are the sort of three latter chapters, and they have a kind of continuity to them. But I think in order to really dive into what participation is and why it's such a tricky and kind of mysterious concept in a way, I needed a different starting point. And the word participation and the concept participation actually has a very long history in the way it's used in philosophy, Western philosophy primarily. And there's a sort of minor tradition of people who talk about this. And Levi Brühl is probably one of the most... one of the people who spent the most of his life trying to figure out what this term meant and how to think about it as a philosophical concept. And the way to understand it is that it basically has this ancient tradition of thinking about the relationship between the real and the ideal. So if you've ever, anybody who's read Plato's, Allegory of the Cave understands this relationship in Plato, and it's taken up in theology. It becomes something that's sort of core to theology. And what the first chapter does is really take a look at how that theological term got turned into a sort of secular one, especially with Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the notion of the general will, right? It's to take something which was previously a real theological problem, the coincidence of human and divine will, and turn it into something which was a secular concept for politics, which is to say the collective decision to pursue the general will in Rousseau. And that's really the moment in history when we start to get this notion of democratic participation, right around the invention of liberal democratic institutions in the West, and the idea that we would somehow need a mechanism for coordinating all of these individual wills into something more general or collective. And there's a nice, kind of story there that's really interesting and somewhat arcane. It means getting deep into some things that are pretty obscure. But Levi Brühl picked up on this notion because in the midst of thinking about the colonial era, the late 19th and early 20th century, he was trying to explain something different, which was, why is it that when people go around the world and participate in other places, right, become what we now think of as participant observers in anthropology, they so frequently end up being completely perplexed by this, right? Why is it that their ability to understand or to make sense of the way that other people see the world is so perplexing to them when they do this? And he turned that into a kind of problem that he wanted to work with. Lévi-Brûlé is really kind of a controversial figure in anthropology, not just because of his, participation in colonialism, which, puts him in plenty of equal company, but also because, for many years, people took up this challenge that he seemed to be laying down to identify what I think has later been thought of as radical alterity, right? That somehow people around the world have a radically different way of thinking about the world or way of grasping the world. But for him, it wasn't primarily an epistemological problem, which is what it got turned into. It was actually primarily an ethical problem, and he wanted to think about it in terms of personhood. But people didn't really pick up on that aspect of his research, I think. So that chapter kind of lays out where I see him providing us a way to think about what participation is, what participation is for. It's not just democracy, but it's also a way of cultivating a kind of ethical personhood. So,
absolutely, yeah. So for him too is thinking about. If I may just read from your book on page 83, what is important for Lévi-Brûlé's approach to this, and perhaps also to Strawson's, is that it is not a list of things deducible from logic or a transcendental analytic that determines the structure of responsibility. Rather, we are soaking in it. And I just thought that was such a great line to think about that connection. But to move on here to think about the connections to the rest of your book. So you do have these intellectual figures who come up, such as Kurt Lewin, or later on thinking about Fals Borda. But thinking about the next chapter on participatory management more generally, and thinking about, as you brought up, participation in work, how does this come about as a concern for people? How does it become a term that people start to use, and what's its use in connection to the psychological and social sciences?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the chapter that's about worker participation is really about the social psychology of Kurt Lewin and his students and these experiments that they did on democratic atmospheres and, sort of thinking about what it means to try and produce a social setting which is more democratic than fascist or more fascist than democratic, right? So there really was an experiment with these large scale questions that they were really interested in. And that in part came out of, there's a bunch of background to that that I think is interesting, but the two most important parts is that it happens at a moment when the labor unions are finally consolidating and finally becoming a force in American life, especially. And it also happens at a moment right after World War II, where a concern about suppressing fascism is something that people have on their minds. And so the folks that were involved in creating participation at work were really trying to figure out a way to control groups of people to make them more democratic, right? And so what was so interesting about these experiments that they ran was that it produced the effects of democracy without really enrolling the people in knowing that they were being democratic, right? So they were participating, but they didn't necessarily know they were participating. And that's a kind of fascinating outcome of this attempt to produce a more democratic atmosphere or a more participative atmosphere. And of course, management picked it up. They loved it, right? Because they were like, we can do this and we don't need the workers' consent, right? So let's just produce more participation and without asking, right? And so, it became a fad that sort of lasted through all of the middle 20th century up into the 70s of trying to produce participation at work through organizing work in different ways, through different kinds of procedures. And what's interesting about that is that it too, as in the previous example I mentioned, really started to tend towards a question of individual behavior and contributory autonomy of individual workers and not the experience of workers as a group, right? And so it really became something where people became obsessed with things like measures and metrics of satisfaction at work or ways to control motivation at work. And those things are actually now kind of deeply embedded in most corporate culture, especially in HR departments, right? Because they have a kind of psychological hold on, or a social psychology hold on making workers happy or keeping workers satisfied, right? And And that all comes from a kind of sense that what you're doing is producing democracy in the workplace. Of course, the labor unions did not see it that way, as well they should not have. And they saw it as yet another way that the management was manipulating workers in the workplace.
So. Yeah, I think about that a lot today with, I think you make the connection to it being so, I guess, proceduralized that it's almost this, the same kind of participation as clicking like on social media or something mm-hmm. like this. But I also think of like current worksite wellness programs and things like this. Mm-hmm. And it's like you're where you might be automatically enrolled and you're participating only in the sense that you don't have a choice.
Right. So, yeah. And this is, you know, I wanted to make the point that participation, like we need a better understanding of participation. We need a better model for it than things where, you know, you get to participate, but you don't know that you're participating. I don't think that counts as real participation. Right. So,
yeah, I just love the ad that you have on page 119, where it's from Nation's Business in 1953, mm-hmm. where it says new methods of employer employee teamwork carry the old suggestion box plan right into the profit column.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's an important part of the story too, is that, you know, participation, in the workplace got a lot of traction, and it became a topic of management research for many, many years, and still to some extent is, because it has a double function. It supposedly makes the workplace more participatory and produces satisfaction for the worker, but also produces productivity, right? I don't think workplaces and management would have given a hoot about it if it hadn't been something they could claim produced more productivity. And the original experiments that Levine and his students did claimed to prove that, though there's a lot of a dispute about that in the literature. But what I thought was so interesting about that, and again, the reason for reconstructing it and trying to get at the experience of it, is that the workers who were involved, they didn't experience profitability per se, right? What they experienced was collaborative innovation. Like they were asked to participate in redesigning their jobs and thinking about the product they were producing. And for a very brief moment, they were like, oh, we're being asked our opinion and we're being asked to participate in producing a different product. And that was a very unusual experience for them, right? But of course, it didn't last because it was only an experiment, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So that brings us to the program that you talked about earlier, the Model Cities program, which, if I remember correctly, was connected as part of Lyndon President Johnson's program related to the war on poverty and Great Society. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. And in this case, thinking about participation in a way that includes not just particular citizens, but also thinking about technical assistance and engagement experts and mm-hmm. What they call ladder of citizen participation. So how did these ideals of participation come about, and what does it have to do with, in particular, things like, in this case, race and class in the 1960s?
Yeah. So the Model Cities program was an interesting case. I came to it in sort of two different ways. One is that it's a fairly well-known but a little bit understudied part of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. It was part of the economic opportunity programs from that period, and so it was very controversial to begin with. And it was a success in some places, and like in Philadelphia, it ended up being a big failure, not because of the people who were involved, but because Nixon came into power and essentially put an end to it. But that story of the Model Cities program is also at the heart of this, you mentioned it, the ladder of citizen participation, which if you're someone who studies participation, you're going to see this ladder everywhere, right? It has been reprinted hundreds of times. People have remixed it. They've turned it into other kinds of ladders. And, you know, so it's just a really common way to think about what participation is. And it was actually created by Sherry Arnstein, who was one of the key leaders of the Philadelphia Model Cities program under the Department of Housing and Urban Development in the 60s. And so she was right there in the middle of it, having this experience of watching what it meant for the people who were involved in urban planning in the Model Cities program to experience participation and to experience both its power and its failures, right? And so the ladder that came out of that, that she designed for this short article, was really built on exactly that story. And that's often forgotten when it's reused. So I wanted to kind of reconstruct that story there. And the story is, you know, an interesting story about democratic participation, but it's not participation in legislation or in rulemaking or in elections. It's participation in the administration of a program, right? Which before that point had pretty much been done in an ad hoc way by American citizens, you know, according not to the rule of law, but to the rule of men, right? Like whoever got to be involved, got to be involved. And so you can imagine how that would reproduce all of the kinds of racial and gender and class inequalities that already existed in society. So what the Model Cities Program did was to try and formalize that. They essentially legalized participation and said, if you're going to have a Model Cities Program, you have to have, and the quote is, maximum feasible participation of the affected communities. And so that was what produced the demand for people to participate, but also the need to provide things like technical assistance. The Area-Wide Council, which was the group that ended up being the participant in the Model Cities Program, was actually paid salaries. They were given enough. They were given enough money to do this as a kind of full-time job, and they were given space to do it. They were given the rent was paid for, and then people in the government and also paid consultants provided technical assistance for doing things like writing proposals, documenting stuff. So it was really a very different definition of participation from what we think of today, which is all fully voluntary. It's not funded. You know, we live in a very different climate with respect to participation than in the 1960s. And so it all looked like it was going to work out really well. But as I say, part of it was that the Nixon administration scuttled it. But that was also it was also a problem because it produced a kind of weird supplement to normal democracy. Right. These folks weren't elected, though they were required to exist by law. And so you can imagine the kind of turbulence that creates, for instance, at City Hall, where City Hall, and especially with a democratic machine like Philadelphia had, was trying to maintain control. And so they didn't necessarily want these folks messing with their control over the city, even though they had a legal right to. So, yeah, so it's a really interesting story of the turbulence of trying to force participation to come into existence.
Yeah, I think, and we'll talk about this more later, but I think, you know, one of the tensions that you talk about throughout this study is that there's this tension between embracing participation and critiquing it. And of course, in many of these cases, you have people who are well-intentioned, but they're experimenting ostensibly. Mm-hmm. And so we see that especially, I think, more than any other, perhaps in the participation developed chapter on international development and the different approaches by, say, Robert Chambers and thinking about United Nations and a World Bank, and then these other more, you might say, more grassroots, even though supported by academics, the more participatory action research, mm-hmm. grassroots approaches. So could you tell us a bit about the two different approaches here, and specifically what were the tensions involved in that development?
Yeah. So that tension you're talking about is threaded through the book, and it is, I do try to identify like who's an enthusiast for participation and who sees participation as an oppression or a containment strategy or a, you know, something that's fake, for instance. You know, so Sherry Arnstein, in writing The Ladder of Participation, was actually making a critique. She was saying, this isn't real participation. It's just participation in participation. And The Ladder was intended to show us a way out of that. It ended up becoming a kind of enthusiastic tool for producing more participation, ironically. So that kind of thing does happen across the book. There's this tension between the two. In the international development case, there's a kind of very long history to thinking about you know, community development as a form of participation in the 50s and 60s. And then in the 70s, really the emergence of these new discourses of participation in the UN primarily, but then also in more non-mainstream places with participatory action research allied with folks like Paulo Freire, or with later with Robert Chambers, who was really just a kind of conventional development agent, very successful in some ways, who discovered participation as an alternative to the way that development was being done in the 1980s and 1990s. And so each of them has their different enthusiasms for it and their different suspicions for participation. To take just those last two there, the participatory action research and the Robert Chambers case, they kind of, in a weird way, cross. There's a sort of chiasma to them, which is like, you know, Chambers begins being super suspicious of participation and how you would never actually want that. You want more managerial control over development, and ends up being one of the most sort of fervent supporters and enthusiasts for participatory development by the 1990s. Whereas the participatory action research people, and there's a lot of different strands to that story, kind of come out of an enthusiasm, a utopian enthusiasm of someone like Paulo Freire, and eventually become much more critical as participation, again, becomes kind of proceduralized, formatted. It gets turned into, the whole point of the chapter in some ways is that it gets turned into a toolkit, right? There's this sense that participation becomes something that you can box up in a little briefcase and carry around the world and produce wherever you go. And so for a lot of people who were originally taken with participation in the participatory action research world, that seems like a kind of selling out of what it really could do. And so those stories kind of weave back and forth in that chapter, going back and forth between that enthusiasm and that suspicion or criticism of participation.
Yeah. So what can you tell us more about the toolbox, and maybe you could also tell us a little bit about some of the discussion around consciousness raising at this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the toolkit is an interesting part of the story. It actually kind of, it was a bit of a surprise to me because I was, you know, just looking for information about participatory development and discovered that there was actually a literal toolkit, in the library that I could go and look at, which was a box full of these games and procedures for producing participation. And it was, you know, such a find in a way, because you think about it from a science studies perspective, it's like we're always looking at tools and we're looking at techniques and looking at material culture and whatnot. And so this was a really interesting case of that. And I started to ask the question of what it meant to try and put participation into a toolkit like that and how it works. And a lot of the things that are in there are actually, in some ways, many of them are kind of attenuated versions of what Kurt Levine and his group did in social psychology in the 1940s and 50s. And so there's actually kind of long continuity to that. Others are more recent. They come out of things like adult education or practices of, dealing with small scale participatory pedagogy in the sense of Paulo Freire. So I often joke that it's sort of an attempt to stuff Paulo Freire inside a briefcase and carry him everywhere because he can't be everywhere at once. And so that's kind of the role of it. And, you know, Freire is really interesting because he's the sort of high theoretical warrant for this, right? He's, you know, his book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, is this long meditation on, Hegel and Frantz Fanon and, you know, how to produce this change in consciousness, this real sort of phenomenological change in the way that people perceive the relationship between themselves and the world in order to liberate them, right? And it's a very sophisticated analysis. And so it's very weird to see that then turned into a kind of procedure where it's like you do this step-by-step thing. You know, if you do this, then you do this, then you do this, then you will have your consciousness raised, right? It never felt to me like that would be the right way to approach consciousness raising, right? Mm-hmm. But it turns out actually, I think Paulo Freire was kind of into that. Like if you read the book, there's a lot of very procedural things in there. He's very precise about what you need to do to engage in the pedagogy of the oppressed. Despite all of the philosophical rhetoric, it's got a lot of precision to it in many ways. And so I started to see a continuity there to this kind of proceduralization that I thought was quite interesting. So.
Yeah, I was also interested to hear some of the discussion around Orlando Falsborda, because I feel like his place in the sociology canon is I think he needs more, you know, attention to his work. I think Joanne Rapoport just came out with a book on him called Cowards Don't Make History. But I was wondering if you could talk briefly about him and his collaborators. And I don't know, maybe just because I happen to be in a phenomenological Marxist reading group, but that's just, you really would love to hear how that came to, you know, Marxism and phenomenology came to be an influence on him and some of these other folks at this time doing this kind of, how that lent itself to thinking about participation and specifically participation as something it lived and experienced.
Yeah. So I'm no expert on Falls Borda. I think he's, you know, in terms of thinking about participatory action research, I wanted to bring him out as, because he's one of two people who often get associated with the term. The other is William White, who's much more of a North American phenomena. But Falls Borda is very interesting, along with a lot of the other folks who were involved in participatory research, like Bud Hall, and oh, there's a Swedish woman, I'm not going to remember her name, but Rajesh Tandon. So there's several of them who were sort of leaders in this world, who were connecting. It was a very mid 20th century thing. They were connecting essentially across a lot of the non-aligned nations, and, you know, doing work in places like Latin America and India and Tanzania, and really sort of viewing development and also resistance to development, and in Falls Borda's case is thinking about things like armed struggle from a very different perspective than the sociologists and economists of the North who are visiting these places, right? And so it is a kind of underappreciated, at least from a North and Western perspective, take on how sociology, economics, and participatory action research developed. And there was a lot of talk of, you know, of decolonization, of alternative approaches to sociology. And some of my favorite images in the book actually come from a book that Bud Hall and Rajesh Tandon produced that, you know, has these like just, you know, sort of striking images. One of them is a picture of an SS soldier, essentially. It's got a big shield that says SS on it, but it stands for social science, right? And not stormtroopers, right? And so
that's my favorite image of the whole book.
Yeah. So and you know, so they were quite strident in their critiques of Northern and Western social science. And so I think, you know, if I had it in me, or if I were an expert in that area, there's a lot of work to be done to really bring that to our debates today about, you know, what should be our genealogies in terms of the kinds of things we do when we talk about development or sociology of you know, non-European or non-American places, right? So
absolutely, yeah. And I think that, well, something you are clearly an expert in is STS. So you do bring in some STS scholars to talk about participation, but specifically thinking about its relationship to ongoing studies on expertise. So how did you bring this work into your discussion, and how does this help us think about STS beyond more traditional science and technology studies, and thinking about, you know, outside of that, like infrastructure or, yeah, participation or expertise?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, as I said, you know, I'm definitely not the first one to this game here. And there were several people who I think really taught me how to think about this in science studies. And a few of them that have been most influential, Norcia Maris's work on material participation is absolutely central to the way that I, you know, think about this, as is Javier Lazon's work. And he's actually written quite a bit about Kurt Levine and his democratic atmospheres. Matthew Kearns and Jason Chilvers wrote this great book, Remaking Participation. And so there's actually a lot of work out there already that I didn't want to really try and, you know, redo in any ways, right, or reinvent. Mm-hmm. And so I really do rely on all of that. One of the things that I think about how science studies has come around to this is that you've got a kind of dual movement that's been happening in science studies. One is the generalization, I would say, from a kind of Latourian angle of the approach that he pioneered. So Latour, you know, took his method and applied it to science, but it's just as easy to take it and apply it to other domains. In fact, he wrote, you know, a book about the French Supreme Court, right? And so applying the tools of science studies, this kind of tools of this materialist actor network approach to a different area. And I think when you come to look at participation as one of these kinds of expertise that you can apply those tools to, it starts to open up all kinds of questions. And that's in part what I was doing, I think, with this book. But there's also another angle to it, which is probably more visible in the work that Matthew Cairns and Jason Chilvers do, but also in a lot of the European STS stuff, which has been focused on making science more participatory, right? Just trying to open it up to more democratic debate, you know, thinking about how to run consensus conferences, how to get more input from citizens in the, you know, science policy of nations, and the tradition of Alan Irwin and the sheep farmers of Cumbria. Sorry, I'm blanking on his name all of a sudden.
Brian Wynne.
Brian Wynne, yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, that tradition for sure has been giving momentum to a kind of part, you know, making more participatory of science for decades, right? Mm-hmm. And I think at a certain point, my book is sort of running a little bit counter to that, because it isn't about a more participatory science. It's really just focused on what is this thing, participation, and how does it come to look the way it does? And also, how are we missing an important part of that story? And I think if there's something that I hope people in science studies will take from this, is it's really this question of how participation is also a practice of ethical personhood. It's a practice of trying to figure out how one's ethical orientation toward the world is shaped within different kinds of collectives and through participation. And so it's not just a kind of empty box where we want more of it or less of it, but rather something that has a kind of quality to it and changes with respect to what one is participating in and with respect to what the makeup of collectives are. And for me, that's important in thinking about things like social media, because those kinds of collectives have become quite, as I think we're all aware, quite toxic and quite difficult to navigate as an individual. And so understanding better what participation is supposed to do might give us a better understanding of how we might want to think about reforming the systems we've created in social media.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was actually wondering if we could just for a couple minutes here, just talk about more contemporary examples, ones that you bring up in your book and discuss at least briefly, thinking about the sharing economy, thinking about participatory budgeting, and thinking about these sort of, you know, at least quasi-algorithmic participation going on today. So I was wondering if you had some thoughts on that that you wanted to share.
Yeah, I tried to end the book with some, you know, as one is often called to do, you know, some advice for the future or whatever, or some actionable outcomes of having written such an arcane book. I don't know that I have the best advice for it, but I do feel like, you know, because participation constantly wavers between something that people are enthusiastic about and suspicious about, it really does pay to think a little bit about what that concept is and what makes participation, you know, for lack of a better word, authentic, right? What makes it actually really work. And so some of the things that I think we ought to be paying close attention to in, say, the domain of social media is to really be thinking about the diarchic nature of participation, right? Is this something where participation is a two-way street? And I think with most social media platforms, it's pretty clearly not the case, right? We're not involved in governing those platforms. We're not involved in making any kind of meaningful decisions about them. Rather, we're just sort of sites of extraction for those platforms. And so I don't think that at this point doesn't surprise anybody. 10 years ago, it was hard for me to convince anyone that that was a danger. But it's pretty clear that, you know, we've gotten to the point where, you know, these are not participatory platforms in any meaningful sense. But then also, if you think about something like citizen science, or what is now increasingly being called community science because of politics around immigration, even that, I think, is something that scientists should, and science studies scholars should, really be thinking twice about whenever they promote it, which is to say, is that actually a diarchic kind of engagement? Most such efforts, and I exclude my colleagues in science studies here, but most efforts that are pioneered by people in doing community science of that sort really start with scientists and engineers saying, we have a problem, we've identified a problem, and we think we can solve it, and we want people to help. And not in the classic science for the people, or the sense of science as a kind of ground up or grassroots process, really engaging with people to identify the problem or characterize the problem, and then in a participatory fashion, find a way to solve it using the tools that we have. And so that, you know, that relationship is one that I think is quite broken in most of what passes for community science. It's very good at producing contributory autonomy. I love, you know, whipping open the iNaturalist app and taking a picture of some animal or something just as much as the next person, or identifying a bird and a bird count. It's a sense of participation, to be sure, but it's a very, very limited form of that. And it's not one that we as democratic individuals really have much control over. And that has consequences for our ethical personhood, you know, what it really means for us to feel as though we have both rights and duties and obligations in a democratic society.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's to me, I don't know. I do some studies on, you know, behavioral labs, and just thinking about these types of participation where you're ostensibly just a data point for the researcher, or set of data points rather. And you're contributing in some way, but you're not really part of the research design and implementation and the applications of it. Right.
Right.
So I think in the end of your book, you do make this call for more of a less of a contrast between, or conflict between, participation and expertise, but more about thinking of mobilizing or scaling expertise. Could you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah. So one of the things that I think when you think about these scientific projects like this, you know, often what happens is the expertise comes first and the participation then gets added to it, right? And I think that what that does is it makes expertise quite stable. And I think for a lot of people in the university, that's a comfortable place to be, or academic researchers, right? The expertise is the stable thing, and the participation is this kind of ephemeral thing that contributes to it. And what I think I would like is for people to imagine a world that's the reverse, where it's the participation of people in science, in engineering, whatnot, that is stable and that drives things. And the expertise is what's mobile and flexible and applied to different problems in different places. And that's a pretty radical reconfiguration of the way in which scientists and engineers are asked to think about political problems. But I think the kinds of controversies we're seeing in science all the time are a good sign that maybe we need to go more in that direction, not less, right? Even the climate change stuff, right? If it's not just a question of people denying the science, it might also be a question of whether or not the science that we're doing with respect to the climate is actually responding to the kinds of queries that people have about the climate, right? And that changing that balance between democratic participation in the conceptualization, the questioning, the design of what we do research on, and the actual performance of that research probably is a reorientation that would benefit a lot of different problems. And my sense is that if you want science to solve democratic problems, then you have to let democracy in, right? You can't just keep on, you know, pointing to the science and being like, believe, believe, believe. You have to let democracy in to let it solve those help solve those problems in some ways.
Right. Yeah. Which sounds very, very much a needed discussion today in terms of COVID, amongst other things.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, we've taken up a lot of your time. I was just wondering before we go, if you could just let us know what the next project that you're working on.
Yeah, well, this might come as a surprise to some people, but it's totally unrelated to this. It's one of those pleasures of being an anthropologist, which is that when something falls into your lap and you realize that it's an interesting thing, you just take it. So I've actually been doing, for the last couple of years, pretty extensive research on animals in Los Angeles. And the way I've been doing that is by spending a lot of time with pest control professionals. And it was, you know, it's an odd thing, but I got into a research project where people were asking questions about zoonosis, which is also very, you know, sort of timely topic in the city, and mammals in Los Angeles. And they wanted a cultural anthropologist. And they said, well, you know, we really need to understand human-animal relations or conflicts in the city. And I, of course, have been keeping up to some extent with all the literature and multi-species ethnography and all kinds of animal studies stuff. And long ago, you know, I count myself as a student of Donna Haraway's. So I always have her in the back of my head saying, what about the animals? And, you know, so I took the chance to think about it and have been, for the last couple of years, seeing Los Angeles and seeing animals from a very peculiar perspective, which is from the perspective of the people who are called upon to kill them and or to poison them. And that's been a really illuminating and a really amazing way to think differently about wildlife, about biodiversity, about human-animal relationships, more than human ethics, all of those things. And so, yeah, totally different turn. I'm not quite sure how participation relates to it, but nonetheless, pretty exciting research project. So maybe I won't make any promises, but someday we can do a podcast about that project when that book's done.
So. I would love that. Yeah, no, it sounds like a great project. Yeah, I just want to thank you again for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, take care.
Thanks very much for the great questions, and I appreciate the chance to talk about the book.